Welcome to the Pardes Parsha podcast. My name is Zvi Hirschfield, and I have the distinct privilege and pleasure of discussing the profound analysis and deep insights into the Parsha from my wonderful colleagues at the Pardes Institute. So glad you could join us. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting, I know it's going to be exciting because of our guest, Parsha podcast. We are crossing the Atlantic. I am in Israel, and our wonderful guest, Rabbi John Lehner, is in Brooklyn. Did I get that right?
You got it.
Where John, among other things, also is an educator, but also serves a community rabbi.
Prospect Heights Shul.
There you go. There's an ad for Prospect Heights Shul being put out there as we speak. John also happens to be good friends with the director of Pardes North America. And so we love John for a lot of reasons, and John's an alumni. So we are thrilled to have you with us. Thank you, John, for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So, John, some would look at this and say you must have lost a bet, the fact that you got Parshat Metzorah as your Parsha. Vayikra, Leviticus, is filled with parshiot that some would find very challenging. Not a lot of narrative in Vayikra. But not only do you have a Parsha with no narrative, you have a Parsha that deals with the purification ceremony for somebody who has tzara'at, which I realize we sometimes translate as leprosy, but is probably better just left as tzara'at, some kind of interesting, undefined skin issue that creates some type of tum'ah, spiritual impurity, that the person has to leave the camp. It's complex, it's complicated, and the ritual that describes their purification is equally complicated. So I guess question number one, John, did you lose a bet, or did you actually choose to speak about this parsha?
I think, one, I'm a disturbed individual, because there were some open slots, and I picked this as a challenge. But I will also say, since coming out of COVID or through COVID, I feel like these Parshiot Tazria Metzorah take on a new meaning, and one that we probably can relate to a little bit better outside of the ailment of the skin.
I imagine you're referring to the idea that the Metzorah is isolated, is quarantined, has to leave the camp, is not allowed to be with others. And wow, who can remember COVID now? We're in the middle of a whole other thing.
I know, but there probably wasn't so many other paradigms within a Torah context of somebody having to be in quarantine.
That is certainly true. So tell us where you want to go with this challenging Parsha.
So it is a challenging Parsha. And even when people say leprosy, that still doesn't help me understand what's going on here. I don't know about you, Zvi.
No, it doesn't help at all, and it doesn't even seem to be leprosy, and that's never helped me. It's all been under this file of the mysterious.
When these parshas opened up to me was when I saw one of the opening rashis to the parsha. I'd say up until this point, these were very difficult parshio to access. Normally, it's a double portion. As you mentioned, if you were a bar mitzvah kid, you would not want this as your parsha. But this Rashi says when the Jews would come into Israel and they would knock down the walls of these homes that they were in, that they were originally Canaanites, once the disease spread into the walls, Rashi says that they would discover gold that was hidden inside the walls.
So Rashi here, and I think he's echoing the Talmud, if I'm not mistaken, decides to go in the direction of, well, you think that having this quote-unquote disease on your walls and having to take apart your house is terrible, it's a punishment, it's awful, what's going on here? And Rashi flips the tables on us and says, well, actually, it's good for you because you're going to tear down those walls and find hidden Canaanite gold.
Right. You would have never found it had you not had the leprosy and had to totally deconstruct your home. I actually think Ramban also uses the language of, you know, seeing the tzara'at as something holy, even though you get it from doing Lashon Hara is probably the most classic example, but only somebody on a very high spiritual level would get it.
So this is being interpreted as some type of divine intervention, whether it's punishment or whether it's actually a blessing. is, I guess, also hidden to us. But you're saying that Rashi is not only affirming this idea, this is not a natural occurrence, this is a supernatural occurrence, but not only that, what we have thought is destructive and punishment and bad is actually good.
Yeah, and I think the idea of divine intervention is really important. What do I mean? We normally go through our lives in a state of ambiguity. We don't know if what we do is good or bad, right? And that's part of living in the modern world. But Rashi gives a context of, imagine living in a world where Hashem intervenes and gives you a status report of where you're at, right? Because if you start developing these weird ailments on your skin, it's a sign that something's off, right?
So you're like getting your midterm grade from God, basically.
That's how I see it. I mean, it's also an interesting connection that it can only happen in the land of Israel also.
Well, I guess in a way, having God communicate that way, even if it's negative, is still a blessing because it gives me a chance to course correct. It gives me a chance to realize something isn't right. It takes me out of my either naivete or ignorance or, you know, lack of focus and says, hey, something is wrong here. You need to do something to fix it.
Yeah. And as a sports fan, it reminds me of, you know, the good coaches who, you know, tell their players, hey, listen, you're not doing this right. You're hurting us. Right. And I think sometimes coaches don't do that. And then that kind of can go on, that style of play could go on and it could not lead anywhere. So instead of seeing the critique as a curse, I think it lends itself to see it more as a blessing.
Okay, so critique is a blessing. I think my wife would agree with you if that's the case.
Right, mine too.
If that's the case, I'm incredibly blessed almost all the time with her loving and accurate critique. So take us a little further. How did you then, you said this Rashi set something up for you. Where did you go from there?
Right, so this Rashi to me can serve a much larger purpose than just seeing it in relation to the Metzora. I see it as a paradigm for perhaps opening up Jewish theology's response to suffering, right? That here's a perfect example of something terrible happened. The walls of your home are literally crumbling, right? You can't think of a situation that would be worse than that. And Rashi's saying, in that, there's going to be gold, or I'll translate it as blessings. And while I think that's disturbing to some people, right? The notion that you have to experience suffering to receive blessings, it's hard to ignore a lot of Jewish sources that tend to agree with that idea.
So share with us, before we dig in and we talk about maybe some of the challenges of this, maybe share with us some of the sources I know you've discovered that lean into this idea, this challenging idea that suffering can indeed be a source of blessing, or it could emerge later as a source of blessing, even if we can't see it in the moment.
So one of my favorite rebbes is the Eish Kodesh. Rabbi Shapira was the rabbi of the Warsaw Ghetto, and his writings were later found buried, I believe, underneath the destruction. And much has been written on him and tracking his Devar Torahs and how the theology changes as the war becomes different and the struggle becomes more real. But on its surface, this is a perfect example of a man who's trying to inspire his people in a time of utter darkness, right? And use the Torah as a way of navigating that.
Okay, so what did he say in this context here?
So on this parsha, he writes this in April 13th, 1940. So this is the beginning. And as I said earlier, his theology changes and becomes more dramatic. But in the context of the Metzora, he picks up on the fact that when you think you have Metzora, right? When you believe you have this ailment, you can't say definitively that you have it. To quote him, he says, a person must say, it looks to me as if there is something like a leopardess mark in my house, right? You yourself can't say, oh, this is a curse, right? And he goes on to say, even if he is a scholar and knows the exact definition of this mark, he still must use the phrase like a mark, right? So even a person who, let's say, is a pious person, right? And he himself also can't make this judgment himself in terms of saying, this is bad. And he concludes by saying, for me, as we have said above, a person is never able to tell whether what is happening to him is a curse or an event. All he can say is, it looks like it's a curse. The truth, however, as the Torah announces, is that what God is doing with us is for the good of Israel.
Wow. So this is very challenging. He's building on the idea that no matter how much a person knows about the laws of Nigaim, of Sara'at, and all these different things, until the Kohen comes and pronounces the whole thing as Tameh, as impure, a person at most can say it looks like X, but they can't pronounce it. And it sounds like what you're saying is he's saying the same thing about all forms of difficulty or suffering, that a person can never understand fully the meaning or the full meaning of the event that's transpiring in their lives. They can say how they experience it. They can experience it as a tragedy, as something awful, as something terrible. But he's leaving open this door or this perspective that says, just remember, as a human being, your ability to judge that is always limited.
Right. And you can view that in many different ways. I think for me, one, the Kohen's role is almost pastoral, right? As if you need another person, you need to be in relation with another human to fully understand your experience. And some will say that's terrible, right? You should be able to, you know, observe and say what you're experiencing as definitive, and you shouldn't need another person. Or you can say this is very powerful, right? That you need to be in relationship to help process what it is you're experiencing.
So help me understand where we're going to go with this, this idea that I'm limited in my ability to pronounce final judgment, even on suffering or painful moments. Where does that take you?
Well, it opens up, I think, a dangerous paradigm, or I think for some people, a very empowering one. And throughout my rabbinic career, I feel I lean into this Torah, right, of saying, oh, in this suffering, there's a blessing. You just can't see it yet. And then there are times when I feel it's a crutch and it's apologetic and it leads nowhere. And it actually can be offensive to people who are going through a really serious moment in their lives.
So how do you, both personally and you mentioned professionally, how do we use this wisdom in a way that doesn't just make us feel terrible, right? That, you know, you're asking me to find blessing in this terrible moment. Give me a sense of how you sort of figure out in which setting or which moment this could actually be helpful for a person to hear and where you would think this is just not the right time for this message.
Right. I think when the person is in it, right, they're really within the suffering. Let's take, you know, somebody who is in Shiva, for example, right? So they're within a very small window of extreme suffering, right? The person just died. They're in it. I would feel like, especially if, let's say, you know, somebody died, God forbid, in a car accident or in some sort of accident, it wasn't a planned death, to come to their home and sit with them and say, listen, I know it's bad, but there's a bracha in this, right? Like there's going to be gold in your walls, so to speak. I think for a lot of people, that's not going to sit well.
It'll make them angry, probably.
Well, would you want somebody to say that? I'm curious.
No, there are very few instances where I am able to hear that, both on a personal and a national level. But let's keep moving because it's very interesting. Give me a setting, or for yourself personally, where you have found that approach to actually be helpful and strengthening.
Yeah. So after I have healed is when I feel like that Torah is really helpful and gives meaning to what I just went through, right? So when the wound is open, so to speak, I don't think this is the Torah I would pull out of my back pocket to try to comfort somebody. But afterwards, right? After, and again, once you've experienced a trauma or a death, you may never fully recover. So let's say you have a scar, right? I think this then starts to add some meaning to what you went through. And I would say most importantly, it opens you up to a brighter future, right? Because you're looking to see blessings.
You know, it's interesting. I want to sort of be lidayek. I want to be precise here. It sounds to me that you're turning to the person and saying, when God forbid that close family member died prematurely, that that event itself, that person not being here is not the blessing. But somehow the trauma you've gone through has strengthened you or opened you up to other things that can be a blessing without suggesting that somehow the score is now tied, right? That the suffering and the blessing have balanced each other out. It sounds like you're not saying that, but rather it's important to try to see if a tragedy or a trauma opened up something for you that may indeed be understood as a blessing.
Totally. And I love how you frame that. And if you read the Rashi or the Midrash carefully, the gold is already in the walls, right? It happened long before that person even got into that home, right? And I don't know if we want to open the can of worms of predeterminism and whatnot, but I think without going there, that piece is really important, which is to say, the blessings were there, and maybe it could have been revealed in another way, right? Maybe you wanted to just redo your home, right? And then you break the walls and you find it. So it's not saying that this is the only way you could have, you know, gotten the gold, but it is one of the ways.
And if I understand you correctly, it doesn't justify the suffering, but it leads one maybe to a more optimistic or positive understanding of their own life, as opposed to seeing their lives only a product of trauma and pain and difficulty.
Right. You could kind of view yourself as Job, right? As a character who's just constantly afflicted, perhaps as a test, but where does that lead you?
Yeah, it's almost like you need that strategy. If you don't believe you have any gold in the walls, it's pretty hard to get up in the morning. And it sounds like what you are saying is we have to use any and all opportunities to see the gold. And I also like the metaphor of the wall in the sense that there seems to be something about us as people, which is very strange, where we are reluctant to see blessing. And I'm wondering if you've ever encountered that also, that people just don't want to see the blessings that they have.
Yeah, I think that's a real struggle. And part of my work pastorally is experiencing people talking about that. They go through their lives and I'm sitting there thinking, they just aren't seeing that this is a bracha, right? That what's happening is a good thing. And that goes actually back to the Kohen. I guess I yearn to be a Kohen, but we need people in our lives, right? To sometimes wake us up and say, hey, listen, what you are experiencing now is really a blessing. And if you don't take pause, you're going to miss it. It's going to be over.
You know, it occurs to me, and I know you brought this text, so I'm not surprising you with it, but the whole idea of gamzu l'tova, right? That everything is for the good, which is sort of not where you were going, but it's an extreme formulation of it, where really what you think is bad is actually good. I always found that to be a step too far, that it didn't allow me to acknowledge the loss or the trauma. But I'm sort of wondering, you know, what you do with that phrase in your own life, even how you try to understand, or do you try to understand ultimately is everything being for the good?
Right. So this is one of the classic stories in the Talmud with Rabbi Akiva. All these terrible things happen to him. And after each one, he says, Gamzu l'tova, right? This too is for the good. And in that story, he actually says it after every terrible thing that happens to him, which for me is not relatable. I personally am not on that level of being able to do that. I do think though at the end, when it's revealed that all those bad things that he experienced as good actually saved him, that to me is a time when I'm more willing to enter into that conversation.
Right. I guess the problem is, what happens if it's never revealed to us? We have to trust that it's there. Like Rabbi Akiva gets to see it happen, right? Oh, they made me sleep out of the city. Great, because it turned out an army attacked. You know, my donkey was killed. That's great, because it would have alerted the people that I was out here, and my rooster and my lamp, all these things. But he got to wake up in the morning and see it. And I'm wondering, are you suggesting that that morning will come? Or do we have to cultivate a certain trust that even if we can't see it, we have to somehow trust that it's there?
Yeah. Well, we're skirting along here without really poking into, I think, some of the more obvious examples throughout Jewish history and what we're experiencing now. I would say the most classic example of the dangers of applying this Torah would be somewhere along the lines of, we had to experience the Shoah, the Holocaust, and the horrors, and the bracha, or the gold that came out of it, was the establishment of the State of Israel. I'm sure you've heard that before.
I have heard it many times, and it's never sat well with me.
And why doesn't it sit well with you?
Well, first of all, I always imagine that if God wanted to give the Jewish people a state, he could have figured out a way other than 6 million Jews dying. And I don't know if the scales are balanced that way, like 1.5 million children lost to us. I don't know if that's balanced out in that way. I don't know, just the whole idea of creating an equation, or this had to happen to make this happen, I just feel like it's putting us in a situation that's not only hard to defend, but it's hard to understand. And I don't know if it makes me feel closer to God. I think, if anything, it makes me feel more distant from God.
I totally agree with you. And I would say that's why you have to be very careful when you pull this Torah out to share, right? Because it could be really offensive and troubling, right? To say, oh, all of this senseless death had to happen in order for this to happen, right? And I don't know if the Esh Kodesh is, you know, maybe he has the ability to do it because he was alive and experiencing it and able to talk to the people in a way that maybe we're not supposed to be doing.
You know, I can't help but go, you brought it up, but and we're in the middle of it, right? Since October 7th, we are now a couple days away from being 6 months into this thing. First of all, I'm wondering if people, congregants and students, are coming to you to ask you to help them make sense of what's going on, not just in Israel, but in the States and around the world for Jews everywhere. And, you know, I'm wondering, do you think in it as we are, we could still try now looking for blessings, or is it just too early and too raw?
Yeah, I've been hesitant to use this Torah or share it, even if maybe internally I lean on it to find some sort of light within all of this darkness, right? But it does feel too soon. We're still in it, right? But again, like our previous example, there's senseless death. People are dying, right? And to then say, this is going to lead to something incredible, right? And we wouldn't have been able to get there without this. That to me does not feel like a Torah of compassion.
But is it something that deep down you still hold on to and try to believe?
Well, that's the paradox. In times of desperation and darkness, you want to say, hey, there's got to be something beneath this, right? And I think it gets into larger questions of how intimately involved do you feel that Hashem is in the world, right? And I think even within the context of Jews, there's a huge disagreement in terms of how much God plays a role in our world today.
And we're always in that trap, right? Because if we say God's not involved at all, then God's absolved of all the bad stuff that happens. You know, very Maimonidean, most of the bad stuff that happens simply a result of our own poor decision-making or lack of wisdom or the order of nature. But then God's not involved. And then we don't have that moment of hope that God is going to fix it, or God is behind it somehow, or there's an ultimate reason. On the other hand, when we go in the direction of God is very involved in the world, which, as you said at the beginning, bringing us back, that's what the laws of Tzara'at are basically trying to teach, right? That God is so involved and sending you signals all the time about how you're doing and what you need to do and where to find the gold and when you have to leave the camp and all those other pieces. On the one hand, wow, that's amazing. God is involved. But then you end up saddled with, well, if God is so involved, how could this God that's meant to be about mercy and compassion and love, why would that God generate, create, or allow all this suffering? So we're in the midst of a really awful choice, right? Where I can embrace the world of Tzara'at and live with the consequences of feeling God's unfairness and distance, or I can live in the post-Tzara'at world where skin conditions are treated by a dermatologist and not by a Kohen and not by a rabbi, and disease is a result of viruses and bacteria or genetic issues, and I don't find God behind every corner. On the other hand, I've solved my problem of wondering, you know, how God could allow this to happen, but now I'm left with the challenge of what's it mean to live in this world without knowing that God is there propping me up.
Absolutely. And I feel like the Jewish calendar mimics that paradigm that you're talking about. We just came out of Purim, which is a holiday where we celebrate and God's name isn't mentioned in the core text, in the Megillah. Right?
And yet. Well, I'm saying, and yet we affirm God is there.
And
right?
We affirm God is there. But I think there are Purim Jews, right, who are more comfortable with seeing God more in the background, right, versus Pesach Jews, where God is intimately involved, literally taking us out of Egypt, right? And so those are kind of two models of saying, are you wanting God to be so intimately involved that God can intervene and help you and save you, or are you more comfortable with a hidden God?
And I think a lot of us nowadays, just to fill out your metaphor, are Tisha B'Av Jews, where instead of Eicha, the famous Midrash of Ayeka, right, where are you? We're asking where the God of Purim is, where the God of Pesach is, where the God of Rosh Hashanah is. And we're doing a lot of wondering. And the inevitable clash, I would imagine, for reading this parsha of divine intervention with this experience, I can only speak for myself, of a sense of Ayeka, you know, where are you in all this? And what is it you want? And what is it you want us to fix or not fix? You know, how are we supposed to move through without knowing that you're with us? You know, I feel like we're in the middle of that that very challenge right now.
Absolutely. And one of the other sources I was looking at in preparing for our talk today was the Baal Shem Tov. And, you know, I think his Torah is maybe the most provocative. He says, when a man is visited by suffering, he should reflect on the allegory of the father of a small son who disguises himself so as to frighten his son, right? So you imagine the scenario, almost like a peekaboo, the father's hiding or wearing a mask. And he goes on to say, if the son understands and sees that it's really his father, he cries out, "Father," and the father turns and gives him a hug. But what if the child does not see that, right? Is unable to see his father in that disguise. Then what are we left with?
And where's the hug?
And why did you do that? You could have just given me the hug without scaring me.
Yeah, I would really appreciate the hug right now. Okay, so I think you've given us a real prep for going into Pesach, even though you're talking about the Parsha. This idea that our ability to look for signs of redemption or believe in the ultimate redemption, even when we can't see it happening in front of us, that the story is going to end in a good way. Just like leaving Egypt ended in a good way. And it sounds like you're telling us, you know, choose to try to see God in the story, as hard as that might be to do.
Yeah, because what's the alternative? That doesn't leave one in a hopeful way. And some people may be okay with that. I'm not, right? I don't think that's a healthy way to go about.
Okay, everybody. We're going to stop here. You've given us a lot to think about. You're challenging us to choose God, hope, and optimism, even in the face of profound difficulty. And you're basically saying that we have no choice. Without that We're living in chaos and purposelessness and no meaning. And so we have to figure out how to strengthen that muscle of belief, really, or trust, or hopefulness, even in very difficult, challenging times, without denying that the times are challenging.
Absolutely. I think that's the most important part, which is acknowledging that there is suffering while also opening ourselves up to potentially seeing the blessings that are there for us.
All right. So you're giving us a bracha to see blessings even when they're very hard to find.
Very hard.
Okay, we're going to pause there. I want to thank Rabbi Lehner for joining us and inspiring us. Because we tape these a few weeks early, it is, I'm speaking for both of us, it is our profound hope that by the time you're hearing this, the hostages will be returned to their families healthy and well, and there will be peace in the land of Israel, and we will be blessed with really quiet and unity and all the blessings that we want. But as of now, they're not there. So we continue to pray and hope for a positive outcome. The sooner, the better. We want to wish all of you a Shabbat Shalom. And thank you, John, for joining us. We look forward to hearing from you again in the future.
Thanks for having me.
Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Pardes Parsha podcast, recorded here at Nomi Studios in Jerusalem. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode and gained some new insights and perspectives on the Torah portion. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite streaming platform and leave us a 5-star review if you enjoyed the episode. Your feedback helps us reach more people with these important conversations. Thanks again for listening, and we look forward to exploring the Torah with you again next week on the Pardes Parsha podcast. Shabbat Shalom.